I'm Josh Braun, and this is Inside Selling, a podcast about selling without selling your soul, where I explore how to get better at selling through the simple acts of having integrity, being honest, and thinking like a buyer rather than a seller. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming another wicked smart human to the show, Khalid Salah. Khalid is the co-founder and CEO of Invesp, which has helped Fortune 500 brands like 3M, Dish, and Discovery turn more website visitors into customers. One of the reasons he helps his customers kick so much ass is that he uses a customer interview process called Jobs to be Done to uncover prospects' unmet needs or wants, which he then turns into sales copy. We have a lot of ground to cover, so let's jump in. This episode of the Inside Selling Podcast is sponsored by the Badass B2B Growth Guide, a series of plays that you can run to start more conversations with people you want to get in front of. James Bowden recently picked up the guide, and here's what he had to say. I've booked meetings with the VP of Analytics at Match.com, Director of Digital Platforms at Johnson & Johnson, and the Director of Digital Experiences at Starbucks, with responses like, "Very amusing intro email, James," and "The best cold email I've ever received." These are huge logos for us. Your B2B guide has changed the way I approach writing cold emails. Just wanted to say thanks. If you'd like to pick up your guide, check out academy.salesdna.co. Now on with the episode. What problem does Jobs to be Done solve? I always like to start these podcasts not by talking about the thing, but like, why are we even talking about this thing? So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, here's the biggest challenge, whether you are in marketing or you are in sales. Ultimately, you need to build a strategy. And then after you have a good strategy, a good understanding of, like, you know, then you build out the tactics, correct? Here's how I'm going to implement the strategy. At the very heart of the strategy is understanding what motivates people to make a decision, correct? Whether in marketing, so you're initially doing that demand generation where people are, oh, you piqued my interest. I know who you are. Oh, you've piqued my interest. Now I have a need. And now let's go through the sale process. And Jobs to be Done really hones in and helps you uncover what motivates people to make a decision. And it took me years of really trying to figure this out. And then, like, look, this framework was out there for almost, like, you know, 10 years or so. But the minute I saw it in action, I'm like, wow, this is exactly what I've been looking for. I was watching a video that you did explaining the Jobs to be Done. And in it, you said, you know, when you understand Jobs to be Done, it's almost like you see the Matrix code for the first time. And that's exactly how I felt. Sometimes, like, you know, everybody says, focus on the customer, put yourself in the shoes of the customer, be customer centric. And in all honesty, when I started hearing these things, especially being in marketing for so many years, I just hear blah, blah, blah. And people get annoyed with me. And I'm like, man, I mean, it's marketing 101. It's easier said than done. How do you do that? How do you actually put yourself in the shoes of the customer? How do you understand them? Forget about, like, you know, all the nice theory. Jobs to be Done gives you the tool to do that. And that's what I think is extremely powerful.
But now, Khalid, you've been in this for a while. How have people been getting a handle on people's motivations historically? I mean, people are doing this already. There's marketing teams that are not using Jobs. They're trying to figure out motivations. I mean, I just got a document yesterday from a client sending me all these personas. You know, Bob is 24 years old. He lives in Minnesota. He likes to do X, Y, and Z. What's the problem with traditional approaches for getting motivation? What are people doing, and what's the problem with it?
So a couple of things. So it's funny that I now, like, and I will talk about personas. I think they have their place in marketing. We've actually published a book back in, 2010, and we had a whole chapter dedicated to personas and how we create personas. And we still, until now, charge quite a bit of money to help companies create personas. I think they complement Jobs to be Done. But here's the problem. You're trying to understand visitors and their motivations, or customers and their motivations. How do you do that? So there's one of two traditional ways that companies follow, and ultimately, like, you know, try and figure out visitor motivation. One approach is you sit there and you do one-on-one interviews, you do focus groups, you're asking questions, correct? Trying to uncover the visitor or the user motivation. The challenge with that is when you ask those questions, people do one of two things. They give you either top of mind answers, very superficial answers, which can take you really astray and cause you to spend tens of millions of dollars in the wrong direction, or they tell you what they think you want them to, like, you know, you want them to say. And that's even worse. I'll give you an example. So 1920s, all these buildings, high rises had elevators in them. And there was a problem that many buildings face and many residents of those buildings face, which is basically the long wait time in an elevator, waiting for an elevator, and then also standing in an elevator. So the architect surveyed all these residents from so many different buildings, asking them, what's the solution? And the solution was simple. That's what people told them, build more elevators. Well, so they actually start doing the budgeting, and it's like, wow, the buildings are already built. How are we going to build the elevators? And we're going to have to, like, you know, tear down halls. We have to do this and we have to do that. That's what people told them when they conducted qualitative research, when they conducted user research. What's the solution that somebody smart came up with? No, instead of doing that, let's just put mirrors in the elevators. And people get to start looking at themselves, and they don't feel very socially awkward having to look at other people. So top of mind answers could have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. Simple solution was very simple. Let's just put the mirrors. That's the challenge when you're talking to people. The other challenge that I see, and you've probably seen this nowadays, especially on the web. And if you've seen those, you visit a website and you have a small survey that pops up. What are you trying to accomplish today visiting our website? What's preventing you from converting? You know, how can we help you? And these are good tools. The problem with them is they give you very few data points, one or two data points from a lot of people. There is no context around them. And with no context, again, you're not fully aware of the visitor motivation. Because lots of times people, by the way, don't even understand their own motivation. And this is always like a sort of interesting. So, and I'm going to stop over here because I can talk about this for hours. So we've gotten this coffee machine that my brother-in-law gifted me. It's like a $400 coffee machine. And I look at it and every day I use it. I get frustrated. I'm like, $400. It cannot keep the coffee warm for more than 30 minutes. Come on, guys, user research, basic user research. And I'm sitting there and thinking to myself, like, I need to buy a new coffee machine. So this is like my daily ritual, go to Amazon and look at different coffee machines, trying to make the decision of the right coffee machine. And today I stopped and I'm like, I wonder what my real motivation is. Is it the coffee machine? Is there something else? I myself trying to dig through my motivation. And I, like, as I'm like writing it down, like, and I'm trying to do the analysis, I'm like, oh my God, there's so much more deeper issues than just pure coffee.
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of why it matters if you are in sales, because most people in sales haven't done the job of the person they are prospecting. And so there's a disconnect between what a salesperson thinks that person's motivation is and what the actual real person's motivation is. And the result of that oftentimes are emails and cold calls that don't have as high of a response rate as they could if you truly understood the person's motivations. And as you really well stated, Khalid, you can't really ask people what their motivations are because they honestly don't know. One of the examples that I typically tell is if you ask someone why they bought PX90, they might say to lose weight. But when you do a jobs interview with them, what you really find out is they were going to a reunion and they didn't want their thighs to rub together because they wanted to meet that person and make a good first impression after 10 years. So you get these really deep insights. And the reason that matters is you can actually take that language, that rich language, the language that you could only get from the customer, and actually use that in your cold outreach. And I think that's another disconnect. We're relying on marketing. And to your point, the personas have a purpose. But to be able to get messaging, those personas are a little bit, you know, too generic. And so what you end up seeing in emails is, we're going to save you time, we're going to save you money, these kind of generic things. And you end up sounding like a white circle in a sea of white circles. I don't know if you see that as well with the emails that you receive, Kelly.
Oh, I see it in the emails I receive. I see it in social media when people are talking. I always feel like, you know, sometimes some of, like, you know, social media or even emails that I receive and LinkedIn connection requests. Oh my God, I have to complain about that. It's almost like, you know, I feel like somebody's, like, you know, living in a high rise. They open the window and then they scream out loud. You know, I was like, hey, I am here. And they hope that somebody's going to respond to them. And I'm like, no one heard you. You know, it's just wasted words that went into space. Let me talk about LinkedIn, because that's a medium that I used to rely on tremendously to generate conversations. So part of the work that we do is we publish quite a bit of research in our field. So we specialize in conversion optimization, personalization, user experience. And in order for us to publish that research, I will reach out to 30, 40 different CMOs, VPs of marketing, directors of digital marketing. Tell them, hey, you know, we're trying to do this kind of research. Would you be interested in having a conversation? It's a win-win situation. Typically, they provide insights. We also send them the research afterwards. In the past, I used to get about 80-90% of my requests accepted. It's just straight up accepted. Nowadays, I think I was like, you know, for every 100 requests that I send, I get about 10% accepted. And I'm like, wow, why is that? Well, because I look at the requests that I get, and I get about 10, 20, 30 per day.
Yeah.
They're just trying to sell something without really understanding. I mean, imagine somebody telling me, hey, like, you know, we can help you. And this is the most common request that I get. We can help you do lead generation on LinkedIn for your company.
Yeah.
We've helped, and this is the kind of the template, correct? We've helped, you know, 10 other clients generate 5,000 leads on LinkedIn in the last 6 months. So they're trying to, like, you know, prove, like, you know, a case that, hey, that's why we should hire them. And the minute I see this, and I'm like, okay, my whole domain of companies that my company can work with, that my business can work with, is probably about 500. So the fact that just right off the bat, you're telling me that you've generated 5,000 leads, I'm like, oh man, you don't even understand what I'm doing. Or somebody else trying to pitch me is like, hey, like, you know, we can help your e-commerce operation. I mean, this is even worse. I'm like, I don't even have an e-commerce operation. Did you do any work? And you're sending emails. So this is costing you money. But, you know, that's the problem. We're always trying to find shortcuts. How can we do this really quickly?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. A couple points you make are really great. This isn't the fun work. You know, interviewing customers and getting these insights is not as much fun as copying and pasting and sending out cold emails. The other thing, too, is that's interesting is, you know, email's free. I always thought, gee, wouldn't it be interesting if it's not free for the person receiving the email, right? The person receiving the email, there's a cost to them in their time. It'd be interesting to actually charge salespeople money to send emails to see if we actually put the cost and shifted it back, if that would change things. And so the cause of this really is we're getting language from marketing as best we can, and we're using this generic language that Khalid is alluding to in our outreach. And therefore, as advertising legend David Trott so well stated, you're a white circle in a sea of white circles, and everyone's sounding the same. And so that's the cause and that's the problem. So what we want to talk about today is what Khalid and I have been using, something called Jobs to be Done, to be able to get what I call crispy language, language that actually sounds like the customer. So they actually feel like you're actually, as Robert Collier stated, another great copywriter, joining the conversation in their head. And the reason this is important is if you're actually sounding like someone would sound, like the actual words that they use, and they feel like you understand them truly and deeply, they're going to be more open to learning about what you have to say. Because if you're describing someone's struggle very clearly or someone's desire, the next logical thing they want to know is, what do you have for me? But until you can get to that language, your message is going to not be as strong as it could be. So with that, Khalid, can you explain to people, a lot of them listening to this have absolutely no idea what the heck Jobs to be Done even is. How can you best explain it? I know it's a little tricky to wrap your head around, but what the heck is it exactly?
So the famous example where Jobs to be Done was built is McDonald's basically trying to figure out how to increase the sale of milkshakes. And in order for them to do that, you know, they go ahead and they survey hundreds of you know, customers that they're coming in, and people give them different answers. Well, you know, you'll increase the sale of milkshakes by, you know, having different flavors, different thickness. And no matter what they tried, sales of milkshakes remain just constant. It just remained at the same level. And this is interesting because the consultant who was helping McDonald's with this is a common friend, Josh, Bob Mista, out of Detroit, Rewired Group. So then Bob decides, you know what, we're going to do this a bit differently. We're going to go to McDonald's and we're going to camp there for a month from 9 a.m. until 9 p.m. And we're going to watch when people buy milkshakes. So they go there, you know, every day. And they start watching, and they notice that people that walk into McDonald's to buy a milkshake, around between 9 to 11, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., are people who are going to work. And those people are hiring the milkshake because they have a job to be done. And that job is basically, well, I need something that is not going to make me feel fat, is going to last for the next 2 hours. People are not going to judge me when I am having it for breakfast. And that was the job that McDonald's, that the milkshake at McDonald's was applying for.
It's interesting because it did the job better than anything else, right? So if I'm eating a bagel with cream cheese, it doesn't do the job as well because a bagel with cream cheese is kind of messy. It gets all over my car. I got one hand on the wheel, but the other hand is kind of free. So it's competing, to your point, with not other milkshakes, but it's competing with bagels and bananas.
And it could be competing also with donuts, correct? All these. And it's funny, if you're doing marketing for all these other things, typically you're not thinking, well, I'm competing with a milkshake, or I'm competing with a bagel, or I'm competing with a donut. It just puts a completely different framework. They also notice that there are people, families that come around between 5 to 7, typically the dad or the mom with children, and then they buy milkshakes, and they look at that as like a completely different group. Well, that group is, buy milkshakes, the dad is buying the milkshake or the mom is buying the milkshake because they've been telling their kids no, 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 no throughout the day. If you're a parent, you know what I mean. You're just constantly telling them, no, we can't do this. No, you need to do your homework. No. And then they feel guilty. So they're buying the milkshake as a way to get closer to their kids. It's yet a different job that the milkshake is fulfilling. Look at this, milkshake with this resume. It's like, hey, you need a way to get closer to your kids? I am here. Alternatively, you can let them watch TV. Alternatively, you can buy them an Xbox. Alternatively, so many different options, correct? That the milkshake, is fulfilling two different jobs within the same day.
And you can imagine the implications of this, right? So if you're now laddering this back to sales and marketing, if you didn't do jobs and you went with the traditional approach, you're going to be marketing, your marketing messages are going to sound like, we just got these new flavors. Our milkshakes, we've made them, more thick. We've changed the straws. We've changed the packaging. We've changed this. We've changed that. And the reason the sales aren't going to increase is because there's a disconnect between that and the job. With these insights, what do you do with these insights? And you can imagine how much different the marketing and the sales messages are now, having these insights about driving to work and about competing with bananas and about the story with the children that you were just talking about.
Imagine if you're doing the marketing or the sales and you're reaching out to somebody, or we tell you, hey, go ahead and sell the milkshake to somebody at 8:30 a.m. or 9 a.m. What's the message that you're going to use? And what are the alternatives that that person might be thinking of? Correct. And he's thinking, well, maybe I could get a bagel. I could be buying a donut. And you're standing there selling the milkshake. What will you say? It has such a tremendous impact. The same thing, if you're selling the milkshake and you're standing there, at 5 p.m. and you see the kids are coming, what kind of message with their parents, what kind of messaging will you use? So lots of times, whenever we're doing sales or marketing, we focus on the functional aspects of a product, correct? Well, the milkshake, here's the thickness, it's chocolate or strawberry, and here's the straws. If you're selling, let's say you're selling training, let's say you're doing sales training, you focus, well, I'm going to give you 10 different lessons, and I'm going to come to your site, and we're going to do one-on-one. But the reality of it, that's just the functional aspect of how I'm going to describe my service. There is an emotional aspect of how using my service would actually make you feel. And then there is a social aspect. How would you be perceived by using my service? And that is when you figure out the emotional and social aspects of a product, that just takes you to a whole other level of competition. It opens up so many doors.
Yeah, I love that. I love that example. I mean, just to give some further examples on this, because it's such a key point. Let's pretend you're selling something to kill weeds and to make a grass green, right? The functional aspect of it is it kills weeds and it makes your grass green. But the emotional aspect of it is you can kind of be the envy of your neighborhood. You can have the guy, you can be the person with the greenest, greenest lawn. And those are the kind of insights that you get when you do jobs that have major implications from a messaging perspective on your website or in your cold emails or even your cold calls.
Definitely. I always tell people, so we just moved to Chicago And my wife has been bugging me about putting the pictures up on the wall. And you know the famous saying from the professor in Harvard, people don't buy quarter-inch drills, they buy quarter-inch holes. And I was looking at this, and every time I mention this in a conference, people say, yes, yes, we agree. And I was telling them, I don't know about you, but I've never bought a quarter-inch drill, nor a quarter-inch hole for that matter. Really, what I'm buying a place to hang my pictures on the wall. And I'm not even buying that. What I'm buying is two other things. One is an emotional aspect of my wife leaving me alone and now bugging me constantly about me not putting the pictures up. The other thing that I bought is actually my friends coming in and looking around and saying, oh man, you have like, you know, some nice art wall going on over here, nice pictures of the family. So there's a social and an emotional aspect to that, you know, to that drill that I bought from Home Depot for $150. And imagine, like, you know, if you're doing the marketing or the sales, just completely different perspective.
Completely different perspective. That's exactly it. And so let's get into this a little bit. For people that have no idea how to get started with this, like if I'm a salesperson, I'm a sales leader, or I'm a marketer listening to this, what's involved in this? Like, how do I do it? And I know this is we could go on for weeks on this, but like at a high level, like what's involved? And we could also, we're going to recommend some readings. I sell a book that I'll recommend as well. And perhaps Khalid has some resources as well. But if you want to go deeper, but at a high level, like you have to talk to like 1,000 people. Do you have to talk to 2 people? Like, how do you talk to people? Like, if you can't ask them why they bought, like, how do you get this out of them? How do you get this language out? And then once you interview people, what the heck do you do with it? How do you synthesize it?
So here's what we do. And again, I'll have to say, like, you know, we've learned this from Bob and Bob Mesta. He's kind of like, you know, the whole foundation came out, the theory came out from Professor Clayton Christensen in Harvard. But and he wrote a book about it, Competing Against Luck. But all the case studies in that book were based on Bob's practice. So, you know, nothing more powerful than sitting with Bob Mesta. So here's what we do. We typically, in order for us to do jobs to be done, we conduct anywhere between 20 to 30 interviews with existing customers. That's where we start. People who became customers or who became clients, anywhere between a month to 3 months.
Now, why a month to 3 months?
So less than a month. Typically, you're still in the honeymoon period with the business, correct? So you're still not seeing the problems. More than 3 months, you've forgotten the motivations, and we cannot really dig deep into why you converted, why you made the decision. You might have some assumptions about why you actually made the decision to convert, to actually become a customer. But we like to keep it anywhere between a month to 3 months. We find that we find the most information out of this. So if you're a sales leader, if you're in sales, if you're in marketing, typically what we do is we say, hey, let's go ahead and survey our clients that converted within that period. We send them out a survey. They fill it out. And we're trying to basically, of those 30 people that we're going to interview, we're trying to find out different demographics, basically, so we cover a wide range of demographics. And we would tell them that we would like to conduct a 45-minute interview, one-on-one interview with you. Would you be interested?
And we have, I'll show you guys in the guide that I'm going to talk about. There's actually templates that you can send people, and you usually incentivize them, right? You give them like an Amazon card. There's like the email templates you can send to people that I usually will see like an 80-85% take rate. I don't know if you see those as well.
We definitely are like also around the 80-90% take rate. As a matter of fact, our challenge, and some of it is because we incentivize, so we get to choose. We'll offer people anywhere between $50 to $100 Amazon gift certificates. Sometimes if we're doing it for a client, the client will offer some gift certificates, some discounts on their site. So we get to choose. Usually, like, you know, those interviews, we run them within a period of 2 weeks that we're doing those 20, 30 interviews, and they are exhausting.
So to give people a sense of this, because people are like, well, what the heck is it? Like, I can hear my, so let's actually have you do one on me. So I recently bought a bike, about 2 months ago, and we're not going to do a full jobs interview, but you guys just get a taste of this. Cause this could be a whole other episode, but just to give you guys a sense of what this sounds like, we're gonna do just a little mini role play here for just a couple minutes, and you can hear what it sounds like, and then we'll go out of role play And then Khalid can explain like why he's doing what he's doing, but we'll give you like what it sounds like first and then we'll break it down. So yeah, so a couple months ago, I bought a very expensive, I don't want to say the amount because my wife might listen to this episode and I really don't want to disclose the full amount, but it's a ludicrous amount of money to pay for a bike, a triathlon bike. So I hopefully you won't ask me what I paid for it, but it's a ludicrous, let's just say it's a ludicrous amount. So how would we get started with it? So
Josh, thank you for taking the time to do this call. Let me give you some background about the research that we are conducting over here. So this is an early part of much further research that will take place in a few months. But what we're trying to do is trying to understand how people shop for bikes. So our goal today is to really get your story. There's no right or wrong answers. Ultimately, it's your story of how you actually start thinking about buying the bike and how you went about it. The best way to think about it, think that I'm recording a documentary. I'm going to be the director. I'm standing behind your shoulder with the cameraman. And there are some instances as we're going through the interview that I'm going to ask you just a few questions about the bike and what you're thinking. And we're going to zoom in into some of those scenes. How does that sound?
Okay, awesome. Now, add a role play for a second. So,
oh, sure.
Game off, as Bob says. So what Khalid is doing here is he's framing up this process because it's a little different. As Khalid said, he's making a documentary, so he needs to make sure that when he's asking these questions, he can see the timeline of events. And this is what's the trickiest part about this framework as we get into role play, is that he has to stitch this together to see if there's no gaps in the story. And when I was learning this, this took me a long time to get. I was coached by this gentleman, Ryan Singer, over at Basecamp, and he would listen to my interviews. And it took me a good 5 or 6 to get it. And so that's, as we go back into role play, you're going to see Khalid start a timeline and start to see if he can kind of stitch it together from this idea of an initial thought, like when did I first start thinking about this to purchase. I don't know if you want to add anything, Khalid, before we get back into role play there.
So there are a couple of things that like we say during the intro. So one of the things that I started with by saying, hey, this is going to be a part of much larger research that we're going to do a few months down the line. And the reason we say this, because sometimes when we're asking to interview people, they're afraid that they give us the wrong answer. They're worried. They're guarded. So when we tell them, hey, this is just initial conversations. We just want to know your story. There's no right or wrong answer. There's a much larger research down the line. People's guard is down and they feel very comfortable. Mm. By the way, the hardest people to interview are other marketers and other sales guys, because they think like, well, I know user research. I've done it before. I'm like, just relax. I just really want to hear your story. Don't know analysis, to go through this.
I get it. All right. We're going to go back into role play. Game on.
So, Josh, so tell me, when did you buy the bike?
I bought the bike about 2 months ago. Yeah, 2 months ago. So we're in the beginning of October. So I'd say August 1st.
August 1st. Very nice. What was it? What was it? A weekend, weekday?
Do you remember. It was on a Saturday.
Okay.
And I had just gotten back from a bike ride, and this is a bike that you actually buy online, unlike a traditional bike where you go into a store.
Okay.
This is a direct to consumer model. So I bought it on the web on that Saturday in early August after my ride.
After your ride, was it morning or nighttime? Do you recall?
It was in the afternoon. And game off. Why are you asking such specific times?
So people are always confused when we ask those times. However, the reason we ask for those, and I was going to continue to ask, where were you sitting? Describe the weather. Was your wife there? The reason I'm asking for all these questions, because I want to take you mentally back to those moments. We are digging deep for emotions, correct? That's what we're trying to uncover. And that's the reason lots of times when we initially ask, well, do you recall, was it weekday, weekend? Was it morning? Was it night? Were you sitting at home? Was the door open? Was the TV playing? Initially, people would say, I don't remember. And then you ask a question and they're like, oh, now it's coming back to me. Right. It's almost like a light bulb that goes on in their head. And it's like, I actually remember. Like, it's around, and sometimes they get so specific. It's like, because, that day I heard this news and this is very helpful. And then almost the minute you do that, you're able to open that floodgate of emotions that come out.
Got it. Yeah. And that's the key thing, is if you can get people back to that moment, the memory gets jogged. Okay, so we'll go back into role play. We'll do this. We'll do this a few more minutes. So you can guys get a sense of the beginning of the timeline, and we're game on again.
Exactly. So you said it was in the afternoon, sitting at home.
Yes.
Okay. What were you doing just before then?
So on Saturdays, I typically do what's called a brick workout in triathlon speak. That means I'm going on a 5-hour ride, and then I'm getting off the bike and I'm going for a 1-hour run. I usually will start that at about 5:30 in the morning and finish about 5.5 or 6 hours later. I'll come home, and I took a shower that day and probably had like a quick little protein bar bite to eat, and then jumped on the computer.
So what happened on that ride? What made you make that decision that day that this is it? This is the moment I'm going to do this.
It was envy. I was on that ride that day. I had known about the brand for a while because one of the more popular triathletes, you know, that wins Kona rides it, and it'd be on my radar for a while. But I had a bike that was fine that I had bought, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. But on this particular day, I was next to somebody who actually had the bike. And oftentimes when you're biking, you get stopped at red lights. And if not for this red light and this person on that day, probably wouldn't have been top of mind. But I really looked at that bike and I had a lot of envy. He was telling me a little bit about it. And I was kind of juiced up to finish the ride and get on their website to learn a little bit more about it. I remember that very clearly, actually.
Awesome. So game off. Okay. What you just said for me as a marketer is just a treasure, by the way, a trove of just information. Well, we haven't even dug. This is just kind of as we're just initially having that conversation.
Why is it a treasure? What do you mean by that?
Oh my God. You know, first, lots of times when people buy bikes, you know, and we actually have a client that sells custom bikes. Lots of times you just focus on the functional aspects of the bike, correct? Like, you know, the colors and the weight. And I'm sure those were part of your decision. But what did you say? Envy.
Yeah.
That as a marketer, you know, in my messaging, in my ads, on my website, in my any literature that I use is extremely powerful, but needs to be done carefully, correct?
Yeah.
Now, but just the fact that you just uncovered it just right there is so extremely powerful. So that's number one. Number two, the job was training, correct, for a triathlon. And obviously, the new bike, there is a job there, and the job was fulfilled by your old bike that you bought 2-3 years ago, correct? Your old bike was doing the job. However, there's an aspect that your old bike was failing at. And here comes the new bike and says, you know what? I'm willing to apply for this job. I'm going to apply. Can you take me? Here's my resume. But something else that you said that's so extremely powerful, by the way, you're stopped there at a red light with a guy who has the bike, correct?
Yes.
And oh my God. Imagine that. So lots of times companies talk about influencer marketing, let's hire influence. No. Your existing customer base, because that's really what sold you on the bike, the existing customer base, them showing off the bikes. Imagine if I'm doing marketing and I know that, well, you know, I've sold these bikes. Last year, I've sold 1,500 bikes for an outrageous amount of money, which means maybe those customers who bought the bikes can be my best ambassadors to do further marketing. You know, how can we motivate them? How can we, you know, it's just a whole
other. How can we get more bikes at red lights?
Exactly. Well, not even red lights, but like, you know, they can show off. Like, you know, are they going on rides? Can we give them coupons that they can refer people to us? Can we have them record some videos, you know, and then share on Instagram? There's just lots of things that you have to experiment with, but there's a whole other segment that you can use in your marketing.
It's phenomenal because you're right. I mean, in order for me to have gotten this bike also, I had to get rid or as in job speak, I had to fire.
Exactly.
You know, my old bike as well. And so it's super interesting. Hopefully guys, that gives you like a small, I mean, there's a lot to this because obviously typically what would happen next is, yeah, but when was the first time you kind of thought about it? You didn't just wake up one day and decide to plop down an outrageous amount of money. Like, when was the first time you actually started looking at it? Like, you saw this bike for the first time, and it turns out that was like 5 or 6 months ago, but I didn't do anything about it. And what was going on there? Like, what was going on there? And, you know, what happened next? And what happened next? And you can see if you rewind the clock 4 or 5 months, I actually looked at it. I did some research, but I didn't buy. And those nuggets are really, really, really important as well, because that language is what's happening with customers, because customers will try to stay with what they have. There's habits of the present. I've been using this bike for a while. Will the new one fit? If I don't like it, will I be able to ship it back? I have anxiety over it. And that's, we often talk about value propositions and benefits, but we often don't give a lot of attention to the habits and anxieties. You know, Casper Mattress does this really well. Bob did an interview with someone that bought a mattress. And one of the anxieties is I buy this big mattress from some person online. And if I get it there and I don't like it, I'm not comfortable. Like, how am I going to get rid of this thing? And so Casper solves that because they know that with a 30-day money back, we'll ship it back, you know, guarantee, which sort of eases the anxiety. You guys that are listening to this are probably way too young to remember Lotus Notes, but that used to be the popular spreadsheet. And to get people to migrate over to Excel was not easy because of the habit of Lotus until they developed a import tool that allowed you to import your data. And you see this now in SaaS all the time. If people want to switch software, they have ways to be able to migrate the data quickly because the habit of the present is really strong. And so it's another advantage of Jobs is that you really get an understanding of habits and anxieties. I don't know, Khalid, if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I mean, like, no, so you always want to think about this whenever people are trying to make a decision. There's four things that really are pushing them like in a kind of like in one direction to make the decision and things that are pulling them back. So there are two choices basically that really push the new solution is the push of the situation that you're dealing with. So for the longest time, I've had an iPhone 7. And I travel quite a bit internationally, and I'm like, you know what? I don't need to buy a new iPhone. It's serving my needs. Everything is fine. And for the past 4 or 5 months, I've decided to stay in the U.S., and so I relied more on my iPhone 7. And, of course, the minute I do that, next day, it falls from my pocket and breaks. And I'm like, really? You know, it's just like the next day, this breaks, and then the home button doesn't work anymore. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I gotta get the new iPhone. Now, mind you, this happened in July, June, July. And I'm like, no, the new iPhone is going to come out in September. I'm going to have to wait. But I'm eager every day. Like, you cannot imagine. I'm like, oh, should I switch to maybe like, you know, something by Samsung? So my situation was pushing me, correct? Without Apple having to do anything, without Samsung having to do anything, I'm doing this comparison. There's another factor, which is basically the new solution, and is it really pulling me to actually buy? So Apple is perfect, correct? They, every year they release new products, and people, there's a segment in of their market that just goes out and finds the new product. But lots of times when we're selling or when we're marketing a product, it's rare that you have a solution that people say, I must have this regardless to my current situation, correct? There's something, there's a problem that they're dealing with, a struggle that they're dealing with that they say, you know what, we got to find the right solution. Every once in a while, there is something that people say, I got to have this. I give another example of Slack. At some point, everybody jumped on Slack because there was something magnetic about Slack. I'm not sure what it is. Still trying to figure it out.
And now we have a lot of people not getting any work done. But that's another podcast.
Exactly. So all these things are pushing you, correct, to make the decision. Now, in one direction, in the other direction, kind of forces, like, you know, on the other direction, there is the habit of the present. I'm used to, like, you know, just my current situation. We're talking to a company. They've been talking to us about conversion optimization services. They spend tens of millions of dollars on online marketing every year, and they don't run. What we do is we do A/B testing ultimately, and it's crazy when you're spending $40-50 million in online marketing, not a single A/B test. It's just like you're throwing money out of the way. And my team is like, "What's done?" He's like, "Well, it makes perfect sense. They must hire us." And I told them, "Well, habit of the present. You know, they're used to things a certain way." They have 200-person marketing department that has done marketing the same way for the last 20 years. And they don't feel like, you know, going out and hiring another CR, regardless of what you promise them, all the promised land that you make them. Still, habit of the present is a very strong force.
This is a great point to groove on a little bit. You know, status quo, rather dance with the devil I know, because there's a switching cost. Is it going to work? Am I going to lose my job? I was talking to a client last week, and yeah, but we save doctors $500 a month. I'm like, that's nothing to a doctor. And the risk of switching, is the information going to be shared? Is this going to work? Is really high. So what do you do with people as if you're in sales and you know this information about like with this client you have? Is there anything that you can do? I have strong opinions about this, but I would love to hear yours first. Like if there's really like if the habit is stronger than the push and the pull, from my perspective, there's no sale, but I would love to hear your perspective.
I completely agree. As a matter of fact, I think if you try and push the sale, you end up losing the person completely.
Two
things that you can do. And you know, but before I say them, let me give an example from a company that you're very familiar with, Basecamp. So I am familiar with Basecamp and I've used their products, oh my God, since 2006. How about that? Now, it's funny because I have been looking and we struggle. So we use Slack and we use Trello and we use Jira and we use, oh my God, and then we use Google Docs. For a while, like, and I'm like, it's just a mess. And as a matter of fact, just before recording this podcast, I was just complaining to my partner. I'm like, as the team grows, I just feel lost sometimes with all the different things that we have to do. And I'm like, it's just simple problem with just having good software that allows us to manage the process. And I've been pushing to get Basecamp in instead of all these different things that we're paying almost like $1,000 on every month. But there is a part of me that's extremely worried. Right. There is a cost of the switch. I'm like, what if we switch? And you know, for us switching, it means also our clients have to switch and we have to tell clients stop using all these different forms and then bring people in and then find out that there's a problem. For example, we switch from using, we just switched to Google Docs. Well, Google Drive, G Suite. We switched to them about a year ago or a year and a half ago from Dropbox. And after we moved, we discovered so many problems. For our specific situation that I'm like, really? You cannot share a folder if you're on G Suite, if you're paying them per user, you cannot share folders. It's like that's something that we do with clients regularly. And I'm worried with Basecamp. Now, notice my problem that was created by G Suite and the switch from Dropbox is impacting my decision nowadays to switch to Basecamp. Does even like, you know, do the guys at Basecamp would even think about this? How would they deal with a problem like that? So there are instances, and I'll go back to your initial question. There are instances where the forces of the status quo, the just habit of the present is just too strong. So you just walk away and you say, you know what, not the right time. You know, and you have to have that. You have to be able to walk away. This is because ultimately you're not going to get the sale. And if you believe that, that will make your life tremendously easier. Not the right time.
Yeah, I think this is a really great point. And I want to just groove on it just for a second more because it's, you know, the barbecue guys, this is a really great story and something you can do as a salesperson. And there's ways to do this really quickly when you have a discovery call is to kind of get a sense of if the habit force is greater than the push and pull force. There's ways you can get at that relatively quickly. And if you know that, and if you're buying into the jobs to be done framework, then you know there's not a sale at this particular time, which doesn't mean there's not a sale eventually, because as we talked about, situations change. Right? My barbecue is doing the job right now, even though half of it works, I don't want to switch. But if my wife were to say, we're having a barbecue party for 12, all of a sudden I got to get it fixed or do something about it. When I originally engaged with the barbecue guys and I was thinking about buying a grill, in fact, I didn't want to get one because again, only half of it worked, but it wasn't a big enough struggle, right? Problems aren't enough to make you switch. They have to be intense enough. They have to be frequent enough. Because we have limited resources and we can't spend it on everything. And so at the time, the barbecue guys did something really smart. Rather than trying to push me and incentivize me and say, we're discounting it and we're slashing the price, but only this month, which is what typically will happen. They did something smart that, you know, Josh, you know, from time to time, we send these videos on how you can become a master griller. And would you like to get them? So what the barbecues guys know is they're not in the business of selling grills. They're in the business of helping you become a better griller so that you can be the envy of your neighborhood when you actually have a party or when you cook for your family. And what they did is they'd send me these awesome videos. They were fantastic. How to grill steaks, how to grill chicken, how to make vegetables so nothing sticks. And I would watch them every once in a while because I love grilling. And when the struggle got to be high enough, when all of a sudden I couldn't light the grill anymore and I had to throw a match in there and I was afraid I was going to get a flare up and it was time to buy a grill, the first people that came to mind were the barbecue guys. And so this idea of having a strategy in place, especially for outbound in particular, when you have a conversation with someone and you're doing outbound, they're probably not ready to buy right at that moment because you're reaching out to them. And so what do you do in those situations when you can't close them right away? Do you have a strategy in place to stay top of mind? I don't know, Khalid, if you have any perspective on that.
You've said. I want to interview you because, like, you know, it's just so awesome what you just said. So one thing that you said that was just so critical, by the way, knowing what type of business you're in. You said barbecue guys, they're not in the business of selling grills, correct? There is a lot more to what they're doing. And figuring out what type of business you're in is extremely powerful. I always tell our sales guys, and we do a little bit of outbound. We're lucky that lots of our leads come in because they recognize us through industry events, and we've been around for a while. But whenever we do outbound, I tell them, listen, it's like, you know, maybe it's like 1 in 1,000 chance that you're calling somebody, a CMO or VP of marketing, and they're looking to hire us. I'm like, this just happened. Actually, I can tell you, we ran this experiment back in 2009, 2010. We've had an outbound sales team, and we were forcing it. I mean, those guys made probably close to 50,000 calls and emails. That's like, you know, a year and a half. And guess how many sales we close out of that?
That's a lot of people. 5%?
We closed one deal, my friend. One deal. just like, you know, because people are not ready to buy, correct? You reach out, it's like, oh, great, yeah, okay. And we'll do demos and we'll do, but our contracts are large in size. So, like, you know, they need to allocate the budget, and it's like, you know, they're buying by committee. And I always tell people, I'm like, listen, it's a long-term relationship. Now, here's when we took a different outlook at it, and we said, you know what? We're just going to have conversations, and we're going to stay on top of mind, and we're going to provide useful content. Whenever we have a conversation with a company, we know we're going to close them anywhere between 2 to 3 years. And the minute we've had that long-term planning, it's like, hey, you know, it's fine. You're not ready. Lots of times when we talk to companies, sometimes we'll look at their data and we'll say, you know what? We're just not the right fit right now. You know, you have all these other problems that you need to fix first.
So I love this. It's playing a longer game. It's challenging for reps because they're incented to make money now in this quarter. So I totally get it. But in your situation, it's a really insightful idea to have the ability to have an abundance mindset and to be indifferent to the result. Because when you have that mentality that you have to close everyone, that comes through and it pushes people away. And if you have a good nurture track in place, they come back. I mean, my nurture track is my LinkedIn feed. So when I'm talking to people and I'm doing outbound and it's early on, I don't do discovery calls because there's nothing to discover, really. I'll ask a couple of questions, but I'm sharing a perspective. And a lot of times they've seen my perspective on LinkedIn. But if I'm doing outbound, I'll share a perspective with them, my view on the world, what I think the challenges are. I'll share some insights. And then ultimately, they're not ready to buy it because they don't even perceive there's a problem. But they are connected to me on LinkedIn. This is why LinkedIn's so phenomenal. And they see my content pop up on their feed every once in a while. And when the strugglometer gets higher, when the problem gets more intense, when both sides of the grill don't start to work, when it becomes more frequent, I am top of mind. And then when they come back, whether it's 6 months, 8 months, 3 years, they're now ready to switch and hire something else and fire something old.
So I'll give you a story on that, on the struggle. We've just had a client sign up with us, small company. I mean, they're doing about $7, $8 million, Idaho, young guy. It's amazing. I love those success stories because he's 24 now. And one of the things that we do whenever somebody gets in with us and then they get started, one of the things we do is we do jobs to be done interviews with our own existing clients. So one of the first things that we tell them is, like, we fly to their location. And I ask them, like, so when did you start thinking about conversion optimization for the first time? When did that thought come to you? And he looked at me, he said, well, about 2.5 years ago. And I'm like, 2.5 years ago? He's like, yeah, I was attending this event, and he mentions the name of the event, and he saw somebody speak about it. And I'm like, so what happened? You know, he's like, 2.5 years. He's like, yeah, on and off, I did a little bit of research and nothing really, like, came about. But then he saw the same speaker about two weeks before he had hired us. I'm like, okay, so, you know, you think that speaker, you saw him 2.5 years and then you saw him 2 weeks before. And he said, you know, I started researching. And then he goes online and he searches for videos on conversion optimization. And there is a talk that I gave saying how hard conversion optimization is. Now, what I'm saying is a lot different than what everybody else promises you. Everybody says, oh, we can increase your sales. We're going to double, triple. I'm talking and saying it's extremely hard. You might be able to get 20% uplift after a year of work.
So this is a real key thing I want to just zoom in on just a little bit, is that it's very important when you're sharing these insights that you're not talking like everyone else. Jason Fried does this really well as well. You know, have a unique point of view. You know, your perspective really matters, so that you are standing out, you're a little different. So it sounds like you have a unique perspective that was a little bit different that this person maybe agreed with, it sounds like, or was found interesting, I should say.
Found interesting. I tell you what, I was in London flying back to the US. He emailed me. I don't know how he watches the video at night. I'm like literally like, you know, I'm boarding the plane. I see this email. I think to myself, good chance is spam. Correct. He's like, oh, I just saw your video. Love it. This, that. And I'm like, okay, I forward it to my sales guy. And I'm like, oh, I'll be in the office by Monday. You know, let's talk about this. I show up to the office on Monday. The guy had signed the contract. Mind you, our sales cycles are typically so long. So, you know, it's just like, you know, we go back and forth. And he had a struggle that he had identified 2.5 years. He was thinking about it. Then something happened 2 weeks before, and he's looking again at the speaker. He does the research. He made the decision at that point. It was just a matter of finding the right fits. And we were there with the video at the right time. And he just converted. And he's like, okay, I'm ready to go.
And that's a typical story, right? With everybody that buys anything, as we start to wrap up, you're getting along just fine. You're doing the job, and ultimately something changes, and all of a sudden you're not able to make progress anymore, or you see something shinier like I did with the bike. DJ Khalid, this has been an absolute pleasure. So much wisdom and knowledge. If people want to learn more about you or your company, how do they do that?
So they can visit our website. So the website is V as in Victor, E as in Edward, S as in Sam, P as in Paul, InvestCRO.com. Oh, people always ask me, it's like, Invest, is that investing? I'm like, no, it's Invest. It's a weird name. There was a story behind it 13 years ago. I don't remember it. But you'll remember, like, you know, it's a weird name. You'll remember Invest.com or InvestCRO.com. I am on LinkedIn. I'm trying to be active, learning from you, Josh, actually. Trying to be a bit more active on LinkedIn. So those are kind of the two main platforms that I'm on.
Khalid, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and sharing so many knowledge bombs. You were phenomenal, my friend.
Thank you. I really appreciate being also a guest on the podcast. I've been follower of you on LinkedIn for a long time, listening to the podcast. So love it.
Clearly you have good taste.
Ah, thank you. That I do. And my wife would agree.